Okay, be right back.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, Denny Griffin here, and welcome to the Juror 13 show on Blog Talk Radio. And I might add, this is the final episode of Juror 13. I'll be starting a new program called the Griffin Chronicles next month, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. First of all, I'd like to welcome my co-host tonight, Delilah Jones. Delilah, welcome, and glad to have you with me again.
Hi, Denny. Anytime.
And now I'll introduce our guest tonight, and I'm really looking forward to this show. Our guest is Christina Korobov, and she is a senior attorney for the National Center for the Prosecution of Violence Against Women, a division of the National District Attorneys Association. Prior to joining the NCPVAW, Christina served as an assistant Commonwealth attorney with the Loudoun County Commonwealth Attorneys in Leesburg, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. She handled all domestic violence and physical child abuse cases and was responsible for law enforcement training. Christina was a member of the Loudoun Domestic Abuse Response Team, also known as DART, and she chaired the Child Protective Team Subcommittee of DART. She came to Virginia from Indianapolis, where she was the coordinator of the Indianapolis Violence Reduction Partnership, an initiative funded by the United States Department of Justice. From 1996 until 2005, Christina worked in the Marion County, that's Indianapolis, Prosecutor's Office. She served as the Chief of the Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit, Chief of the Domestic Violence Unit, and as a Major Felony Prosecutor. During her tenure, Christina prosecuted Marion County's first repeat sex offender, a police officer who was manufacturing child porn, and serial rapist Charles Hill. In 2002, she was named Prosecutor of the Year by the Indiana Coalition Against Sexual Assault and received an Outstanding Lecturer Award from Communities Against Rape, Center of Hope for Youth. And I love this part. Defense attorneys refer to Christina as the, quote, Queen of Pain, unquote, and, quote, the Princess of Darkness, unquote. Christina, welcome.
Thank you very much. those are the names that we can repeat. That's what we shared.
Okay.
There are some others.
I'm sure there are. We have another caller on the line. I'll get to in just a minute. First, I wanted to start out by asking you a question, if I could, Christina.
And sure.
That is, you've obviously been involved with the domestic violence cases for some time. And what do you see today? I personally didn't realize how bad the situation was until fairly recently. But do you think there's just being more reported today, and it's really no different than it was 20 or 30 years ago? Do you think there's more of it today? Do you think we're getting a lid on it? Or what do you see the status of the domestic violence situation?
Good question. I think that our officers are better at detecting it. I think that our advocates who work every day with victims have gotten better at encouraging victims to make reports where that's in their safety interest. I think we're recognizing it a lot more clearly than perhaps we used to, and I think that we're seeing it earlier on. We're recognizing now that a lot of the relationships that teenagers are involved in are violent relationships. So we're starting to call it earlier, and then we even recognize it later. I mean, I've prosecuted people who are in their 80s who have violence in their relationships. So I don't know that the numbers have increased. I would say they have not decreased, but we're definitely recognizing it and calling it what it is a lot earlier on and trying to intervene earlier in the process before it becomes a homicide.
Okay, and speaking of that, I wanted to mention briefly a case from California just to actually hit the news Monday. A lady by the name of Elizabeth Fontaine apparently was undergoing some domestic violence problems and a divorce and so forth, and left court ended up allegedly shooting her two young children, her mother, and then herself. Are you familiar at all with that situation, or do you have any knowledge as to what happened or where it stands?
Other than what's reported on CNN, and their last report update was yesterday, they weren't identifying anyone, not with that particular case. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely a part of a phenomenon that we're seeing more and more of, are the murder-suicides, and just where you have an individual who's either is experiencing mental illness or any combination of factors, or it may just be the ultimate act of control, where they end someone else's life and then take their own as a part of it. So that's certainly something that we seem to have seen more of after the economy kind of took a downturn. We seem to get more attention, at least, to those cases. And I think sometimes we're seeing more attention paid to it because the suspicion is, oh, well, this is just tied to the economy. This person was going through a difficult time or they lost their job, and that's why they're doing this, without much investigation into the fact that there may have been domestic violence in the household previously, and the loss of a job was just another stressor that this person experienced that was part of what contributed to the ultimate act.
So there could be multiple factors then involved, not just the economic issue alone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think every one of us knows someone who's lost a job and who's been very sad over it, who's been despondent, who may have even sought psychological counseling but didn't go take a weapon and kill themselves and gun down their entire family as well. There's usually something much more significant going on than simply the loss of a job.
Okay, before I pass the baton to Delilah, let me give out our phone number. If anybody has a question or comment for Christina, Delilah, or me, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. That's 646-478-0982. And we do have a caller from the 920 area code on the line. What I'm going to do is let Delilah come in and ask or make a comment or ask Christina a question. And then after that, I'll bring the caller from the 920 area on. Delilah, go ahead, please.
I think the biggest question that probably myself and everyone else out there has is, how did you earn the reputation of being the Princess of Darkness and all of those other things they're saying about you?
Very simply, I see myself as tenacious on behalf of victims, mostly because, and I think I'm inspired by sometimes how little they believe they deserve justice. When they come into the system, they don't expect to be believed. They don't expect that anyone will take what they say seriously. And when someone does, the way that the victim carries herself differently, the way that she starts to see herself as worthy of being believed, as someone who might get justice out of the system, and that just makes you want to fight a lot harder for them. So I certainly have tried to be fair to defendants and met out justice as their actions and their criminal history merit and deserve it, but I don't back down just because they have a fancy lawyer or because they've got a good story or because they think that it's all the victim's fault. And I try to be consistent with them as well. I tell them that, you know, if you do this again, if you come back, I'm likely the one that you're going to see. So there have been defendants who have been in my in past employments, who've asked their attorney since I've left, please tell me that prosecutor that she's still not on the case. And it gives me that good little feeling in my heart, but makes me hope for the best for the rest of them. So, you fight hard, and victims and whether they're adults or they're children, you want to go in there and you want to do right by them and by what happened to them and make sure that it doesn't happen to someone else or to them again.
Well, do you feel like you use, for lack of a better word, are there some sort of tactics or tools that you use in presenting your cases or prosecuting the cases that you're involved in that maybe someone else didn't think of, or something that you do that's a little bit differently that has allowed you to be so successful in these prosecutions?
When I prosecute a case, I always try to make analogies that a judge or a jury will understand. For instance, when I talk about domestic violence, and I have a victim who didn't tell right away. I talk about the fact that we've all kept secrets before, every one of us, and we keep secrets for very good reasons. Sometimes it's because we don't want to hurt other people in our lives. Sometimes it's because we're just not ready to tell. But that doesn't mean that the secret that we're keeping is a lie. And that's the notion that, you know, defense attorneys try to put out there as, oh, well, if this had been true, she would have told a long time ago. You're like, well, no, not so much. You know, we all keep secrets and we keep them for a reason. When you talk about, you know, victims who don't disclose right away, I talk about, you know, jurors and judges who've had a bad boss before. You know, every one of us has worked for someone who was a bad boss, and everyone kind of gets gun-shy when you ask them to, well, tell me a little bit about that bad boss. They're wondering, is the boss still listening? But, you know, they've had a boss that they've worked for who maybe was demeaning to them personally or may have sexually harassed them in some way or didn't pay them what they deserved or may have threatened them professionally. And when you ask, well, didn't you leave that guy right away? And they're like, no. Well, why didn't you just quit your job? I mean, you're telling me this is so horrible. Why didn't you just leave? Well, I didn't leave because I needed the paycheck. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so is it fair to say that you liked the job, you just didn't like the way the boss treated you? Yes. And so we try to just analogize that same situation to domestic violence, that there's a lot of victims who really love the batterer. They just wish he would quit hitting them. And they may stay in that relationship for a number of reasons, but it doesn't mean that they're not afraid of the violence, that they don't want the violence to stop just because they stay. So we try to just bring it home to judges and juries that a lot of the behaviors of domestic violence victims that sometimes cause judges or juries to acquit, they're really not anything different than any judge or juror has done in their everyday life.
Right. Do you see that these things are being used a little, I guess, a little bit better within our judicial system? I know of a lot of cases out there where women feel, or even men feel, that the actual judicial system has let them down.
Oh, absolutely.
How would you address that?
You're right. There are times when the judicial system is going to let you down. And as much as I believe that it is the best system that there is, there are ways that that it can be made to work better. And that the sooner that we get in and we start working with the victim to help him or her make the justice system work for her or him, the better off they're going to be. But so many victims oftentimes go so long trying to push the justice system away. I don't want it. I can handle it on my own. I'll fix this myself. And the more that that happens, the harder it is then for us to come in and try to clean up is the wrong word, but to try to correct some of the mistakes that have been made. For instance, a lot of stalking victims will engage the person who's stalking them as a way to try to make the stalking stop. But not only does it not make them any safer, but it also makes the case harder to prove up because they've been continuing to have contact with the person who's stalking them. And it's hard for a judge or a jury to believe that if you were really so afraid of your stalker that you would keep calling him back, when what they don't realize is that's just the behavior management technique sometimes, and they're trying to placate this person in order to get the behavior to stop on their own. But we really need them to pick up the phone and get law enforcement involved as soon as possible so that we can make the violence stop that way.
Mm-hmm. And what are your feelings on the orders of protection? I know, you know, several cases where, for instance, the Amy Lechtenberg case up in, I think, Wisconsin, she had an order of protection on her ex-husband who violated it 57 times and ended up getting unsupervised visitation, took the children, and he murdered the children and himself. How do you speak to that?
That an order of protection is only as good as the judge and the police who enforce it and the prosecutors who enforce it. And that's where the responsibility should weigh very heavily on every one of us in the system, that from the minute that order of protection is handed down, that judge needs to say to the respondent in no uncertain terms, I don't even want you thinking about her. I don't want you to drive by. I don't want you to send a pigeon with a message to her. It's done. The contact is over. You know, and to really then strictly enforce those parameters. It's up to the police to, when they get a report that an order of protection has been violated in some way, to go out and to seek an immediate warrant to enforce that order. I mean, every state has a criminal sanction for violation of a protective order, every last one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's as simple as getting that order enforced, and there's criminal ways to do it as well as civil ways. And then it's the prosecutor's responsibility to take it seriously. And there's so many times when the defense attorney is arguing, well, the contact was harmless.
Right.
But do you understand what you just said to me, the contact? When you tell me that there's contact, it means that this person, the respondent, looked at the judge and basically said, I don't care what your order says. I'll violate it if I feel like it. And that's a dangerous individual. And I wish that all judges recognized that mentality in offenders when it exists, and would really give them a good smack. I think if all judges said the very first time you violate the order, you're going to jail, because I need to send you a message loud and clear that my order means what it said it meant. And if you violate it in any way, you're going to go to jail. And I really think that would cut down on the violations. Now, when you have an individual, though, who goes out and murders his family in violation of an order of protection, that's a person who is probably pretty hell-bent on doing it to begin with. It's not the victim's fault for getting a protective order. And many times there may have been attempts at court intervention to try to change the behavior, and it just... Mm-hmm. Especially when you've got an offender with a gun, though, then you've really got to ask, well, why is that person still possess a weapon where that happens? So,
Is there anything that would take away any weapons once an order of protection is served?
Absolutely. Where an order of protection has been served as part of a hearing process, where the individual has been served with the order and hasn't had an opportunity basically to contest it. A hearing's held, they're given notice of the hearing, they have an opportunity to present evidence. And once a judge makes that finding and enters a protective order, by federal law, that person isn't allowed to possess firearms or ammunition. And possession is really a pretty broad term at that point. Yeah, there's plenty that can be done. The issue is getting it done, though, and sometimes recognizing that an offender does have a weapon. Sometimes the victim doesn't know to even tell the court that he's got a gun, or they may know he's got one, but they don't know that he's barred from possessing it. And then we've obviously got the issues where there's still offenders who are purchasing weapons at gun shows or from friends, or a family member's got them and got access to them.
Yeah.
So it's still not...
If they
not,
want one, they're
going to
find it.
Oh, right, absolutely.
Get it.
Please,
yeah,
you can get a gun for $25 on the street, so it's just not that difficult.
So a mother in this situation, what recourse, or does she have any recourse whatsoever against the system after something like this has happened in her life?
I would say, unfortunately, no. There's very little legal recourse against a larger entity unless she could show that someone was so grossly negligent in their duties to protect her. And you look at, for instance, the Tracy Thurman case, which I believe was out in New Jersey many years ago. And the premise behind that case was you have had a police department who so blatantly failed to enforce orders and just clearly failed to protect this woman that it's their actions that ultimately led to her death. It's rare, though, that you've got a case like that. And unfortunately, most of the time what my experience has been is that where someone isn't really enforcing an order, oftentimes it's not just the police that may have not taken it seriously or the prosecutor who didn't ask for the full penalty or even the judge, but oftentimes the victim never picked up the phone to report the behavior. So it kind of becomes a situation where I would not want there to become this massive finger pointing at whose fault is this?
It could start from the top and go right on down.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the victim gets the message that the order won't be enforced, so she doesn't pick up the phone. Or the judge feels like, well, I'm not going to send this person to jail when she's the person who called him. So you've got those competing processes going on. And I think probably one of the best places to really put a lot of the energy at figuring out what went wrong are domestic violence fatality reviews. And many states now have those processes, even counties have those processes for going back and really looking at domestic violence homicides, not just at one homicide, but are there patterns? How do they fit into the others? And really trying to improve the system based on what's happened in the past. I think that's probably the most fruitful thing that we can do when a person is murdered as a result of domestic violence.
What about lethality assessments? For instance, if, you know, when you take out the order of protection, should there be a lethality assessment at that time? And do you think they're being used and used wisely?
I think that lethality assessments are largely being used within the advocacy community on behalf of victims so that the victim can get a better sense of what kind of danger that she's in. And I would say almost all jurisdictions that I've worked in or come in contact with, there's someone in that jurisdiction who's using those tools. Now, the issue, though, is whether the victim ever gets in contact with that person. Because as you know, when a person goes in and requests a civil protective order, they may not come into contact with anyone but the court clerk.
Right.
And next thing you know, they're before a judge, they make their argument, the order gets issued, it gets served, and, you know, all heaven and hell break loose once that order gets served, and no one's ever talked to her about her safety. So that's certainly an issue of making sure we get to those victims quickly.
Right. What area in the system is responsible for getting to that victim to get her the information that she needs? I know exactly what you're saying. I think a lot of people go in and have never had contact with the court system or anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scary situation.
Right.
And they just kind of go do the paperwork, sign your name here, and you're through.
Yeah.
And they don't even know that these things exist. How can we get to them, and where in the system does this come into place?
Well, let me give you an example. In Loudoun County, which is where I worked here in Virginia, we had a program in place whereby when a victim came in to request a protective order, she was directed to our court services unit. And there she met with a protective order intake worker. And this person would help her to fill out the affidavit itself, which detailed what the abuse was. If the victim, for instance, needed someone to interpret for her, they would put her in contact with that individual. They explained the protective order process and how it worked. They explained the different levels of protection that you could ask for. You know, you don't have to ask for no contact. If you just want no assaultive or harassing contact, you could request that. So there was a person who was guiding you through the process and who would also do safety planning with you or put you in touch with victim advocates who had the ability to do that with you. So there was someone in the county who was doing that on behalf of victims. And that person was an employee of the court. It's a grant-funded position. And I think it really increased the chances that a victim would be smart in the request that she made and then in seeking safety afterwards and knowing that this order and the service of this order could have bad consequences for her as well. So there are programs like that that I think need to exist more than they currently do. But that was something that was a part of our domestic abuse response team.
It seems to me like there's got to be a place there within the lineup of the system that the tools that this person needs and the information that this person needs once she gets to that point, there's got to be something in there that's going to give it to her, and I don't see that that's happening in a lot of jurisdictions.
Hey, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. What are your feelings on GPS, on violators?
I like the GPS when the victim is participating in the system. And what I mean by that is I've prosecuted cases. One of the most memorable to me was a woman who had been raped by her husband, and he was allowed out on bond pending trial because he had no criminal history. And so the judge let him out on bond but put him on a GPS monitor. And sure enough, he started violating almost immediately. And we had an excellent individual who was monitoring him, and that's a big part of it, is knowing that you've got a good system in place and a good probation officer, pretrial officer, and he was letting us know right away when the violations occurred, and they were letting the victim know right away, but the printout that came as part of the violation hearing. The evidence that we presented at that hearing to show he was violating it literally showed this man circling around the victim's apartment complex, and then the monitor went dead, which meant he had separated himself from the box at that time. That was the technology, because he had then walked into the area where she lived. And it was, I know it scared the judge to death, and she revoked his bond immediately. So that was fantastic. But many times the problem comes in that the victim at some point may seek to reinitiate contact with the batterer. And so she will go meet him somewhere. Mm-hmm. So we've just spent, you know, thousands of dollars on these monitors when the victim starts meeting the offender somewhere. So it's great technology, but when it's used, we need to know that the victim is in a place in her life where she's willing to say, I likewise will not seek out contact with him. I will not meet him places. And if I want this order changed at some time, I'll come to the court and I'll notify the court that I want it changed rather than just trying to fix it on my own, which we do see happen. So,
right. Ladies, can I cut in for just a second? I'd like to take this caller, the callers around the line since before we started.
Sure.
Okay, caller from 920, you're on. Go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Hi, Denny. Hi, Delilah.
Hi.
Hello.
I just want to say that I think Christina should be cloned across the nation, if it's possible, if we can donate some DNA, because the prosecutors in my area have been less than helpful with my situation and other women that are going through domestic violence, and then they leave the relationship. They finally get the courage, you know, even after a few, I guess they're called trials. And when you finally do leave the abuser, you have children to think about. And that brings into a mix a whole new separate issue of, you know, restraining orders, domestic violence, and now you have family court in the mix. And family court tends to not want to listen to any type of accusations of domestic violence, and there's several fathers' rights groups that are out there debunking, you know, saying that domestic violence is all a big lie. It's a tool used against them. So there you are, victimized again in family court, as I was, you know, where the severe documented history of domestic violence was just completely ignored.
I agree that is a problem, and I think it's a matter of not just education for prosecutors, but education for judges about the correlation that exists between domestic violence and child abuse, and that even where there isn't necessarily proof that the person who's abusive to the mother or the father, to the spouse, has likewise physically abused the children, there's got to be some recognition on the part of our courts that you know, hitting a child's mother, that's not effective parenting, period. It's a sad situation when civil courts tend to ignore evidence of domestic violence or treat mothers with suspicion when they do raise that as an issue. And I can tell you I have seen that happen as well. And so you feel bad for victims who are cooperative with the system because they're treated with suspicion, like, you must be making this up because you want an advantage in your custody case. But then a victim who isn't ready to participate in the system and recants or hides out or doesn't come to court, well, she must want to be beaten. So it has become a very damned if you do and damned if you don't system for victims of domestic violence, that either way, they tend to not be treated, I think, as fairly as they should be.
That's true. And there's a lot of us women out there, mothers that have, you know, are going through this situation, you know, currently as we speak. There's mothers that are going to go into the courtroom tomorrow wet behind the ears, not realizing that the moment that they may say that mm-hmm. this man abused me, that's it. You know, you're
right.
Shut down.
Right. And it's why I have constantly encouraged victims, don't ever try the court system on your own. I don't care what you have to mortgage. I don't care what you have to sell in order to get a lawyer. But because most of the time the batterer has a lawyer. And if the batterer doesn't have a lawyer, so much of the time he's got the presumption of innocence or the presumption of a woman scorned, which sometimes tends to be stronger than the presumption of innocence, working on the batterer's behalf. And so I just encourage, you know, mothers who are going through divorce or custody proceedings, you've got to get an attorney on board. And you need an attorney who understands the cycle of violence, who knows who the people are in your community to tap as resources. Do they need to call an expert witness to talk about the cycle of violence? Do they need to call someone to talk about, you know, the effects of witnessing domestic violence on children? Do they need to come up with agreements so that if there's a visitation exchange, it can occur in a way that doesn't compromise the mother's safety? And really teaching judges and attorneys, both those who represent victims and those who represent batterers, to recognize lethality signs. Because I think that there's some attorneys out there who do represent batterers who, if they had the right information, might make different decisions on behalf of their clients. So I think it's really a matter of getting people to understand the issues altogether.
Yes, I think that education is paramount, and I hope, you know, from your lips to God's ears, that within my lifetime, maybe there will be some change, and women won't have to be put in that situation of either giving up their children or have their children taken away from them and being safe.
I couldn't agree more. It's why I do it, in the hope that my nieces will grow up in a different world.
Well, thank you very much for your hard work. We really
You're quite welcome. Thank you for your persistence.
Thank you, caller. Before we move on, we have a question in the chat room. Ask Christina if she gets many cases where it's the man who was abused by the wife. Do they have the same or similar problems where children are concerned?
I have prosecuted cases where men are victimized by women. The numbers are not even close to the same. My statistics, and I maintained them for a 2.5-year period when I was in Virginia, they ran about 10% male victims with female offenders to the vice versa. Most of my victims, the overwhelming majority, are women. And part of that may be reporting. Part of it, something that we don't even acknowledge when we talk about this, are the male victims of male batterers, that there are same-sex relationships where domestic violence also exists, and that's a very unresearched issue. But when it comes to the issues that these parents have with their children, yes, I mean, they do tend to be the same when you see them. And I think of one case in particular that I worked where the mother was an alcoholic. And she sometimes acted out violently, and the kids had seen it. And there were just a number of problems in the household. But the father loved his children. He knew that he wouldn't get the same amount of parenting time with them if there was a divorce. And by that, it's not that he didn't feel like he'd be fairly treated by the system. It's just that he knew he wasn't going to get to wake up every morning with his kids and go to bed every night with his kids, which was important to him. You know, it was a dilemma. Do I leave my wife, even though she has these issues, or do I stay, knowing that I'll get to see my kids every night? And so you do see some of the same issues surface, absolutely. And there are men, the relationships that I've seen where I feel like the man is really feels very trapped, like most female victims of domestic violence feel, tend to be ones where the woman has a mental health issue or has a drug or an alcohol problem. Those tend to be the ones that mirror what I would think of as traditional domestic violence. Otherwise, there are times when a woman has used force against a man, but it's a crime, and we treat it like a crime, but some of the same elements of fear aren't there, the constant fear, and the power and control dynamic is very, very different, just meaning that it tends to be easier emotionally for those men to leave the relationship than it is for the women.
Christina?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to. I hesitate to ask this question because I only heard one side of this. It was something that was told to me yesterday. So I'm going to relate a scenario as it was given to me, not stating from any personal knowledge whether it's accurate.
Okay.
But let's just suppose it's true, okay?
Okay.
A lady I'm in Las Vegas. A lady from out of state who's having major DV problems in her state had an order of protection back in her home state. She moved. She's trying to get away. She felt threatened even with the order of protection. She moves to the Las Vegas area. This individual that she was having the problems with finds out or tracks her down, starts calling her, gets her phone number, leaving very graphic threats on her her voicemail or answering machine, whichever. She goes supposedly to two different local police agents or police agencies here with jurisdiction and tells them what is going on, that she has the OP back from her home state and so forth. And the story is that that was more or less poo-pooed. Well, you think this guy would really travel 1,000 miles or what have you, know, to do anything? Is, you know, probably all bluster and talk. Well, so nothing was done, apparently. And it was, I guess, a month or so ago now, the guy did show up, and it was a murder-suicide situation.
Wow.
So this girl is dead now. Let's just assume that that's accurate, that type of thing. What should a woman do if she, I guess it could be a man too, but should the victim do if they go to the police and at the time the batterer is not physically in the jurisdiction and say, hey, I'm getting these threats, here's the telephone messages and so forth, and the police don't seem to want to do anything or provide, is what would you recommend to a victim in that situation? What should they do then?
In the situation that you've described, if you've gone to the police, first of all, whether the police accept your evidence or whether they will file a charge, regardless, make sure that you document everything. And you described that this person had kept the phone calls. Absolutely. And don't just keep them on your cell phone. Take a digital recorder, make copies of them, and make sure that someone other than you and someone who does not know the batterer has that evidence. If it means you get a safe deposit box, then you do that. But you need to essentially collect evidence in the same way that the police should be collecting evidence, because you are building a case. One of the reasons sometimes that it's hard to take action on a violation of a protective order that occurs across state lines is that it's just a misdemeanor most of the time. And most states will not extradite for a misdemeanor. So as pathetic as that is for a reason, many times the state feels like, okay, even if we file a charge on this guy, nothing's going to happen with it because no one's going to pay all the money to get this guy back into this jurisdiction to hold him accountable. The second thing, though, is that there are federal remedies for interstate stalking or for violating a protective order, for crossing state lines to do so. So a victim could always attempt to contact a U.S. attorney's office about it. How much success they'll have with that, I don't really know. But it's something that they can try. And, again, you document the names and contact information for every single person that you've spoken to along the way. And the final step is to retain a civil attorney for the purpose of getting that order enforced in civil court, because it wasn't an order issued, presumably, as you've described it, the victim got that order. It wasn't part of a criminal process. So she can always go back to that court and seek to have that order enforced, and that's another remedy that exists for a victim. Again, how successful she'll be, I don't really know. But I tell victims, if you have a bad experience with one police officer, it doesn't mean that you can't try with another. Also, I'd encourage victims, in the event that you're not getting a good response from police, look to one of your local shelters or victim advocacy agencies, because sometimes they have contacts with the police, and they can put you in direct contact with a domestic violence investigator or a domestic violence detective who's specifically trained on these cases and how to work them. And usually the women or men at your local shelter will know those resources. If you have a family justice center in your area, go to that center. You know, that's a one-stop shop most of the time for domestic violence victims. So sometimes picking up the phone and making a report isn't enough. You need to continue to look for what resources are out there to help me to get justice and to protect myself and my family.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Delilah?
Yeah, everything that you've just talked about brings me to another question about what if the abuser is a police officer?
Yeah, that's terrifying. The short answer is, it's terrifying.
This is a terribly big issue. There's just, you know, there's a lot of women out there that are being battered by police officers, and how can you call the police? Who do you call? Where do you go?
Go outside of that officer's agency. And that's, I know that's easier said than done, because I've prosecuted in larger areas and in smaller. And when you're in a big area, it's easier to find someone who doesn't know the batterer. But when you're in a rural community, I can't even begin to imagine the terror that a victim feels when their batterer gets to carry a gun for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And in those situations, it may be best to seek out a federal law enforcement assistance. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is one that's just coming to mind that might have offices in more rural areas, for instance, and a victim could try to make a report that way if she wanted to. Domestic violence exists within every profession,
right,
and every classification of people. It's just scarier when the person that you're supposed to report it to carries a weapon and is the law. So at that point, I think a victim really needs to seek out help from an advocacy agency in her area or in a surrounding community. And there are enough of them these days that a victim can usually find a shelter where there's someone who works there, whether it's a therapist or an advocate who goes to court with the victims, or sometimes a civil attorney who can help the victim make a decision about what am I going to do? How can I most safely protect myself and my children in these circumstances? But documenting, though, is really important, because when a victim is finally in a position oftentimes to tell what is going on, much of the time it seems to me that when they make the report, it's not the worst incident that has happened, that there's so much more in the past. And I always think, boy, I wish I had pictures of those worst incidents, or I wish I had documentation of the more serious ones so that I could try to build a case to get this guy's badge pulled. And it's so, even if a victim is not in a place where she is able to leave the abuser, if there's a way to document what's going on, that may be her best protection.
What do you feel the best ways are for her to document? If she's keeping a journal or something like that in the house, he's likely
bad
to
idea.
Find it.
Yeah, yeah, so very bad idea. Computer journals, bad idea. So many people I've talked to, just people who are going through divorces, and there's no violence in the relationship. They're putting keystroke technology on their partner's computers because they want to know if they're having an affair.
Right.
So if your batterer suspects that you might be telling someone, your technology isn't safe either. A trusted friend, and that's a friend who's not a friend of the batterer's, is sometimes the best person to have help you to document and collect that evidence. I also think about someone at a shelter, and sometimes shelter workers it may make suggestions about safety planning for victims that would include safe ways to document.
Mm-hmm.
Employers. I think about the Susan Still case, the woman who was on Oprah Winfrey show in 2020, whose husband made their son videotape the beating.
Yeah.
And it was that woman's boss who heard things on the phone, who saw bruises on Susan, who kept a calendar of everything that was going on. And the fact that that boss kept the calendar and was able to document, I think it was 35 separate incidences, that's how they got so much time on that batterer, was because an employer helped. And so a victim may have an employee assistance program at work that could begin to help her to document things, because sometimes that's the only place the victim is allowed to go.
Mm-hmm.
She may be allowed contact with the children's teachers or guidance counselors. And so a guidance counselor may be a safe person to seek out. And it's, you know, something that we're really encouraging among domestic violence professionals is we've got to educate guidance counselors. We've got to educate school nurses, because they may be the only one who gets to see the victim other than the offender.
And
so,
coming up with creative ways to do this without the batterer finding out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Because they, you know, if they become suspicious, the victim may not even be doing anything, but it's that suspicion that causes the offender to feel like I'm losing control and may prompt a very violent incident. So, you know, we just tell victims in those situations, trust your gut. You know, if you think that, reporting is more dangerous than not, but at the same time, we hope that at some point you will find someone that you trust enough to tell what's happening. And that person will help.
Yeah, exactly. What about emotional abuse, where there aren't any physical scars, where there aren't any bruises, where, you know, it's hard for a person to describe exactly what's going on, or maybe they do know exactly what's going on, but it's more of an emotional abuse issue. Is that able to be prosecuted?
Sadly, no. there's a short answer. Longer answer is that I think it's probably the worst part of the abuse for the victim.
Right.
I once listened to jail tapes where the offender was trying to get the victim to drop the charges, and he never threatened her, but it was the constant promises to change. But the names that he called her on those recordings, and she answered to them as though he were calling her by name. Fat, stupid, you're bipolar. And literally, though, those things just rolled right off of her. And that's how conditioned she was to hear those. So later on when he would hit her, and that really, I was like, well, but he's beating you. He's tearing up your children's bedroom furniture and bedroom sets. It ultimately dawned on me that nothing could be as horrible as hearing your child's father call you these horrible names. So a punch probably just didn't feel that bad. But it's something that we've got to work with young men and young women to recognize earlier, that the name calling is a precursor to something so much worse. And that's the time to get out. Because once the hitting starts, many times it's so late in it.
Right.
So get out when the name calling and the obsessive behavior starts, and that's the safest time.
How I have a question in the chat room.
Okay.
Who actually precipitated this emotional abuse question, and she wants to know how about the emotional abuse of letting your spouse think you're dead for 4 years. This particular woman. Her husband went missing and then turned up. And it's a case of he maliciously did this, left his wife, his children, his family to just, you know, survive as you can. And what would you say to a situation like that? What is there any recourse?
Probably no legal recourse unless he filed a false police report or something like that. But he obviously, trying to pretend he's dead, wouldn't have done that. I would say if you're looking for the justice system to make things right at that point, it's not going to help you. That's a point where there are trained therapists, not because there's something wrong with you, but because that's a support system, and you need someone at this time. I mean, I cannot imagine being deceived that way and the grieving process that you go through only to realize that a person intentionally did this to hurt you. That is a horrible, horrible, I honestly have not heard of that one before.
Yeah.
But that's a situation where the whole family who is duped to believe something different needs to be in intensive therapy to help them process what happened and to help them go on with their lives. And hopefully to not let this person back in, because so many times that becomes then the response is to allow the hurt to happen over and over and over again, not because it's your fault, but just because you didn't know how to change the behavior pattern. And that's what therapy exists for. I'm a big fan of it. And you know, there's trained professionals out there, not because you're crazy, but because they're trained to help you to make better decisions based on all the things that you already know.
Excellent answer. Switching gears a little bit, I know that you have prosecuted a lot of cases involving child abuse. What are your thoughts on, you know, children who have been abused, whether it be physically, sexually, mentally, however, when they grow up, when they get into their later years, maybe the trauma was so bad that they've blocked this out. What are your feelings on repressed memory, recovered memory?
Oh, I certainly think it happens that that children do bury things very deep, and it's a defense mechanism. And I think that we're going to start to learn a lot more about it with those individuals who are returning from Iraq and from Afghanistan. When, you know, 15 years later they wake up and they have a very accurate memory, not a fantasy, but a memory of something that happened that they had buried so deep because they had to function every day. And I hope that that research will then be used to recognize that, yes, children do and are quite capable of repressing things as a survival tactic. And it just because a child does that, though, or has that, experiences that phenomenon or that survival technique, it's important, I think, for those kids to know that it because you're abused as a child or you witnessed abuse, it does not doom you to become an abuser. And I think so many children hear that and they believe that they are bad and that bad is the only thing that they can be and that the abuse is somehow their fault or that they didn't do enough, say, in domestic violence cases to protect their mom. It must be my fault that my mom got beaten. It's just so important that when we encounter these children that we emphasize to them whether they are currently children living in the situation or they are adults who experienced violence as children, that it was not your fault. It was not your responsibility to protect your parent or to stop the violence. And we're glad that you're safe now, and we want to help you to be a stable, productive, healthy adult.
Very good. it's such a very complicated situation, I think, you know, when the trauma in a childhood is so terribly bad that it is the only defense mechanism that a child, it's almost instinctively a defense mechanism.
Well, think about just, again, the very natural response. When something embarrassing happens to you or to I, do we sit around and do we hope to remember that for the rest of our lives? Or, you know, I just think about even the stupid embarrassing things like me running and falling and giving myself a black eye before a domestic violence conference. You know, I'd really like to forget that moment. And if it was a painful, embarrassing moment, I might work very hard to repress that memory as a defense mechanism. And so it's not an abnormal thing. It's just the body's response to it. And it's tragic sometimes that we say, well, that child must be making it up.
Mm-hmm.
Or was coached by the parent to say it. So
right.
You know, you've got to be careful with those issues. And certainly there are you know, instances where parents have tried to get a child to say something that isn't true. But you know, in many of the cases, it's just the child's response to violence is to shove the memory very, very deep.
That could go into the whole parental alienation syndrome thing, and I don't think we have enough time to get into that.
You're absolutely right. Other than to say that it is not recognized by the DSM. It was solely created to, you know, to defend against children who no longer wanted to be around a parent because they were scared of the parent or angry at the parent. And it doesn't fly. It doesn't hold water.
No.
In my humble legal opinion.
And I totally agree. Denny, have you got some closing questions or anything else that you would like to get into?
Yeah, I'd like to go back, to the order of protection issue for a minute. Now, as you said, Christina, they're only as good or bad, I guess, as the people who issue and enforce the orders. I think generally speaking, and it's been my experience, that an awful lot of people, more than should, I believe, kind of treat orders of protection as a joke. And that's got to come down. When people have that opinion, that lack of respect for the order of protection, it comes down then, I think, to what you said, that there's no when that order is issued, it isn't quite made clear to these people the seriousness of the order, and that if they violate it, it's going to be tough on them. And I don't think, in a lot of cases, I don't think there's a deterrent. Now, am I wrong there? Am I misreading this? Or are they 90% positive? Or are there a lot of these orders of protection that are issued that aren't properly enforced when the victim does make the complaint, when the victim does report a violation?
I don't know that I could attribute ever a number to it or a percentage of ones that are properly enforced. It's because it's going to depend largely on jurisdiction. And I think the key to anything is in successful accountability with these orders is sending the batterer a consistent message that the order, you're right, that the order isn't a joke, that it's a court order. It's not just a piece of paper. It's a court order, and it's a judge telling you to do something. And so really, whether the offender believes that the order is going to be enforced has everything to do with judicial attitude, with prosecutorial attitude, with police attitude towards those orders. And it's just, it's so important that that every message be sent consistently, that that this order is serious business. And there are a lot of ways, very subtly, that a judge or a prosecutor or a police officer can send a message to an offender that this just isn't that big of a deal. And it's why, you know, when I prosecuted cases for violating a protective order, it didn't matter to me if it was the victim who picked up the phone and called the offender, you know, saying, hey, I need diapers for the kid. Well, if the offender talked to her, he violated the protective order. Now, he's not going to get the same punishment as the batterer who incessantly calls the victim. They are two very different scenarios. But nonetheless, it's still a violation of the order. And it was just always important to me as a prosecutor to send that message that the victim is not subject to the protective order. She can't conspire with you to violate the protective order. And I actually had judges and police officers who would arrest victims for violating the protective order. And I'm like, hey, guys, she's not a subject of the order. You're actually creating a crime that does not exist right now. So, a very bad situation. But we had to get those individuals, and it was our arresting judges, and in Virginia they're called magistrates, to understand that when a protective order is issued, it's because a judge found that the respondent poses a threat to the victim. The victim doesn't pose a threat to the respondent, so she's not subject to that order. And there may be times when a victim has contact with an offender that she shouldn't have, and you're right, that's a problem, but it's not an excuse to go out and arrest her. But we've got a lot of batterers who will say that to victims, well, you're talking to me too, so you should be arrested. The manipulation is just unbelievable. So it really is incumbent upon every last one of us in the system to consistently send the message that those orders are laws and they need to be followed.
And when that message isn't sent in a clear manner, that's when things can break down then, right? Because
Absolutely. It would be like if a judge routinely told people that if you speed, you're going to get a ticket. And when you come to court and you try to contest the ticket and I find you guilty, I say, nope, sorry, I find that you sped. You need to pay that fine. And people didn't pay the fine. Why would you ever expect that anyone would pay the fine? Why wouldn't I just speed? I mean, seriously, why wouldn't I just consistently speed? I like to go fast on the interstate. If I know that a judge is never going to make me do the thing that he said I needed to do, why would I do it? I mean, I've said consistently that a batterer doesn't, like, stop hitting or stop violating an order because he wakes up one day and says, wow, I really am a mean person. I need to stop it. You know, they stop the behavior if they do stop it because they're afraid of jail or because I sent them to jail. So, you know, it's just if a judge doesn't enforce his orders, then no one in the system has any reason to believe they'll be enforced. And you know, it's not the way we operate with traffic tickets. So I think it's a lot more important for a judge to, you know, enforce an order of protection than a traffic ticket. So, and that's not just because I have a lead foot, but
so
we'll
maybe
protection
should,
there.
Maybe we should start with educating the judges and holding them accountable and holding them responsible for the decisions that they're making and passing down.
And I think that court watch programs are amazing for that because when a judge realizes that someone is watching him or her and they are rewarded for the good things they do, you know, when you come out and you say, you know, that that was a correct legal decision, it, you know, good for the judge. But likewise, we draw attention to the problems in the system. That's how the system changes. So, yeah,
ladies,
I love Court Watch.
I hate to be like the Grinch, but our time, we're down to about 30 seconds. Christine, I want to thank you so much.
You're welcome.
There's been a wealth of information, very well explained, and I understand a lot more now. And I want to thank you for being on with us, and hopefully you'll come back sometime in the future.
Anytime you need me.
Thank you. And Delilah, as always, it's been a pleasure.
Always.
And let me just take the last few seconds here and to say that Delilah will be with me again when the Griffin Chronicles debuts on January 20th. And we're going to be discussing again some domestic violence with Dawn Schiller. And Dawn, for those of you who recognize the name of Johnny Wad Holmes, was a victim of his. He was the now the late porn star. So that promises to be a very interesting program. So I hope you'll join Delilah and I again on January 20th for the debut show of the Griffin Chronicles. And I want to wish everyone a very, very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for providing this platform and getting the educational tools out there.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad I can help some way anyway. Thanks a lot, ladies. Again, I really appreciate it. And the best to you, and we'll be talking again in the near future.
Thank you.
Good night now.
Bye-bye.
Right.